We respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners of country throughout Australia where this podcast was recorded as the first storytellers, the first communities, and the first creators of Australian culture. We pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hi there, I'm Daniel Moore, and you're listening to Season 4 of the Hearing Architecture Podcast, proudly sponsored by Brickworks. In this episode, I'm speaking with registered architect and director of Prevalent Architecture based in New South Wales, Ben Berwick. Ben is an accomplished emerging architect who has studied and worked around the world, primarily between Australia, the USA, and Japan. Ben and I discuss some of his experiences working and studying in Japan, his unique approach to sustainability and how he has begun to implement it into his practice, and some of his most recent projects. Let's jump in. All right. Thank you so much for joining me today, Ben, on the Hearing Architecture Podcast. It's really great to have you. How are you going?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Daniel. Thanks for the invite. Going well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm actually at the tail end of a cold, but I will survive. And it's not the spicy cough, so I'm hoping I will pull through. So, yeah, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It's really great to be able to talk with you. And I'm really excited for you to be able to share a little bit about your background and what you're working on these days, because it's really exciting stuff. So you're going to be talking a little bit about sustainable materials and what you do in your practice at Prevalent Architecture. But I mean, your background is quite fascinating because it's not the standard trajectory in architecture that most people go through in Australia. So do you want to share a little bit about your background and different places where you studied?
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Daniel. Originally I'm from the Newcastle area, so 2 hours north of Sydney, and then sort of from there I moved to Sydney to study architecture at Sydney University. So that was for undergraduate, so for the first 3 years of the degree, and then after that stage I moved to Japan actually. So that was studying a master's of engineering technically in architecture because that's how it's set up. And that was at the University of Tokyo for 2 years.
Wow. And what inspired you to move to Tokyo to study over there?
Yeah, so I think it was just a differentiation in terms of the learning and especially the content and the delivery of how it is really sort of done in Japan is quite different to Australia. So I think it was kind of just adding on to the undergraduate degree that I had, how it could differentiate the learning, learn something completely different in a completely different way.
Yeah, wow. So do you want to describe how it's so different?
Yeah, so the actual studio culture there, when you apply for a master's degree, you basically apply for a laboratory that you'll work within.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that sort of sets up. You apply specifically for the professor. So in this case, it was technically under Kengo Kumo as the professor.
Wow. Well, you're not going to get that in Australia, probably. So,
I mean, there are pluses and minuses, I think, to having someone like that as a professor. but look, we also had Yusuke Bucci as well, who was sort of on the ground running things more day to day.
Yeah, wow.
And so he'd sort of run the DRL program at the Architectural Association in London, and then was moving back to Japan to set up the studio.
Wow. So you were in this laboratory with Kengo Kuma and then also this other architect who was sort of handling things day to day. So, yeah, how did that studio culture work and how did things evolve?
Yeah, so it was a pretty tight, small studio.
Mm-hmm.
So it was about 8 students per year, so 8 students in the first year of the master's and then another 8 in the second year.
Mm.
And you work really collaboratively. So you do have a few other subjects outside of that studio. But, you know, you're kind of in the studio from, I'd say, roughly like 10 a.m. till sort of midnight, 6 days a week.
Oh my gosh.
it's quite intensive, a little bit different than how university is done in some other countries, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But in that case, you do cover a lot of ground with the studio in terms of, I think, what they focus on and the content that you deliver.
Mm.
So, it's an intensive experience. You're with the same people for quite extended periods of time. So you're able to develop really close friendships and working relationships as well.
Yeah, awesome. And then after you studied in Japan, did you also work there for a little while?
Yeah, so during the actual study, I worked for Sana in Japan. I was a Sana Architects.
Yeah, wow.
Underneath more so Sejima in the office. And then I worked for an engineer, actually. So the engineer that connects a few of the Japanese architects, Jun Sato, doing sort of computational work with him. And then into Ishigami for a little while, Junior Ishigami. And then finally landing at So Fujimoto.
Yeah, wow. Oh, that would have been just such an awesome experience. So how long did you stay there working after you'd studied?
Yeah, so I was in Japan for a bit over 3 years in total. So working there was for about a year, year and a half after graduation.
Mm-hmm.
With kind of pretty intense working conditions.
Yeah.
And then after that point, I moved to Paris, but still working for So Fujimoto.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
There was a bit of sort of overlap there and then going back and forth.
Yeah, right. So now you're in France. And how long did you work there for and on what projects?
Right. So I guess at that point, you know, there is sort of a relationship between Japanese culture and French culture, which is sort of a complex relationship, but also quite a beautiful one, just in terms of craft and the way of working. And so a lot of the Japanese architects were opening offices in Paris at that time.
Mm.
So Kuma had an office, So Fujimoto was opening one, Shigeru Ban, of course, also. So I moved sort of there to open Fujimoto's office as sort of a team of three in the beginning to work on really quite large projects to reinvent the city of Paris. It was the Reinventor. Reinvented Paris, I think, was a competition name, actually, run by the mayor. And there were a few different projects throughout the city where really large scale, really collaborative, with design architects, local architects, and we were the design architects on some quite big projects. So
wow. And so while you were working in these incredible practices, is this where you started to develop your skills and understanding and love of experimentation with materials?
Yeah, look, it definitely could be the case, although probably it started at university, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
In the university sort of studio environment, we had a very interesting project where we're working with Japan Forestries, and a large construction company to construct a pavilion, basically.
Mm.
And in that case, we're working a lot with timber, so Japanese cedar. And this was a case where we had an issue, which was Japanese cedar had been planted in plantations sort of post-World War II in Japan, and causing a bit of an issue now because it hadn't been logged as intended. So obviously issues with species and everything else with plantations, quite a bit of a problem. Now a problem where it's not being logged because the cost of the timber has gone down so much.
Mm.
So we're looking at ways of really increasing the value of this timber and using it in architecture in varying degrees, and particularly looking at the offcuts of that timber and how that can be used in projects. So
right.
It's sort of an interesting project, and it's sort of a lot of information to go into, but that would have been probably what kickstarted the love of materials.
Yeah, nice. I think it's really exciting when architects find different ways to use like waste materials and materials that would otherwise just not be used at all for another exciting building material. So yeah, I think that's a great thing to be experimenting with at university, and I can understand how that would plant a seed for the rest of the work that you've started to work on as well back here in Australia. So did you want to tell us a little bit about some of the incredible projects that you've started to work on now that you're back in Australia and you've opened your own practice? And now we're actually starting to put some of these experimental materials. I'm not sure if experimental is the right word, but some of these new materials into your projects. Do you want to tell us about APA Yakitori Bar?
Yeah, of course. So APA Yakitori Bar, it's a hospitality project, a Yakitori Bar quite specifically, and restaurant.
I called it APA, but it's actually APA, is it?
APA, yes.
Yeah, right. what does APA mean?
Look, I think I'm not even pronouncing it correctly.
Okay.
It's a so the Ainu language is an ancient Japanese language, and APA means basically fire. So there's sort of a clear synthesis, I think, between the yakitori and the charcoal, cooking with charcoal, and the fire that exists within that. So it's very sort of elemental as a business, as a brand, also as a hospitality space.
Mm.
And, you know, we really gravitated towards the fact that if you actually are having yakitori, so it's, you know, generally skewers, right?
Mm.
Skewers over charcoal, whether it's the vegetable or whether it's the animal, you're using all the parts of it. There's generally very, very little wastage.
Mm.
So we were inspired in that regard, at least with the design and the fit out of the tenancy that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of compounding and looking at just waste that exists within different tenancy fit outs, particularly for hospitality. So you have what, a 5 to 7 year lifespan with the average fit out in Australia. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of waste that's produced through these demolition and reconstruction projects.
Yeah.
So to sort of tie it in kind of with the elemental aspect of the yakitori and trying to produce no waste or as minimal waste as possible. We really looked at a few different materials that were shifting the notion of what a fit out is. So rather than utilizing new materials that have been produced for the project specifically, we utilized materials that were waste products as much as possible.
Yeah, nice. And I mean, you make a really good point that in hospitality, because of the type of turnover that exists in that industry, you know, it's a really important typology for architects to get right with their materials, because, you know, if you're factoring in that maybe a fit out will be gone in 10 or 15 years, that whole sort of, I guess, cyclical thought process of where your materials might end up is really important. And it's really good that you'd, I guess, been also working with this client for a while, hadn't you?
Right. Yeah. So we had a bit of a working relationship. So the client was an architecture originally.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked together when I was back in sort of undergraduate in Sydney. I was working for a company. We're working alongside one another. And then he sort of went into the hospitality business, taking over the family business in that regard. And then, yeah, so I've started to design the projects. And I think I designed the first one for him when I was probably 21.
Wow.
So it's been going for a while, this relationship, which is really fantastic.
Yeah.
And yeah, so we had a bit of control with the Appia project, I guess, is what that ends up in. Mm-hmm. Quite a bit of trust and control.
Mm.
So we basically tried to steer quite a bit of the funds of the project into companies that were looking at new materials, or I should say new uses for recycled materials in architecture, and trying to be, for some of the cases, their first, almost like seed funding.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that for a few different materials. One of them was mycelium.
Is that a mushroom, or is it a fungus? Exactly. Is it a mushroom?
It's something in between there, right?
Okay.
It's the very basis for what a mushroom would be.
Okay.
It's the network below the soil that connects all living trees, plants, fungi, everything in a forest.
Right. Okay. That's amazing.
I think it's the world's biggest organism. They can be acres large.
Wow. So how did you use those in the space?
So we worked with a company. They're an Italian based company, Moku, and they're just starting to research and trying to produce these basically acoustic tiles, I guess you could call them.
Okay.
Where they've basically grown the spores of the mushrooms on agro-industrial waste products, so waste product from farms.
Hmm. Wow. So
that's really things that would normally be burnt and would produce carbon emission through it being either a waste product being burnt or taken to landfill.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using that as feed for the actual mycelium.
Wow, okay. So, yeah. You know, I'm a total novice in this area. I mean, I guess I'm assuming that they, you know, you let this thing grow, sort of living organism, and then do they do something to sort of stop its growth so that then it just is a stable product as an acoustic panel?
Yeah, exactly. So typically it grows in almost like pitch black or very dark environments, because typically it's under the soil. You don't really see it in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
So they mimic that process by growing in the dark, basically.
Mm.
And then once it takes the form and the shape, they expose it to light.
Mm-hmm.
And the mycelium itself, it does either slow down and stop growing, or, you know, it's sort of no longer alive.
Yeah, wow.
Once you're getting it, it's consumed what it needs to consume, then it becomes a stabilized product. at the end.
Wow, that's fascinating. So that's a really cool product. So did you use it on the walls or the ceiling in the bar?
Yeah, that's right. So we used it as acoustic paneling along one of the walls in the bar, and we sort of, we used as much as we could. Because in a way it's a carbon negative product, right? So the more you can use, the more waste you're abating, basically, from landfill or carbon from the atmosphere. So we use it as much as possible.
Yeah,
well, where it was appropriate to do so.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess, is the texture a little bit like something like other acoustic panels where it's absorbent, or can you actually paint over it? Like, or is it, do you just sort of apply it raw? How do you use it?
Yeah, so it'll come. I mean, it's three-dimensional in a way, because you still have the waste product behind it that it's been feeding on.
Mm-hmm.
It's not removed from that. So there's actually, there's waste product in the restaurant itself,
mm-hmm.
Behind the actual mycelium.
Mm.
But it comes to you as almost like a block. So these were, I think, a meter by 50 centimeters wide and about 10 centimeters deep. And then the surface condition, you can paint it. We left it exposed. And it has like a velvety finish. I always compare it to like a camembert cheese almost.
Ah, interesting.
It's unusual, and we get a lot of people touching it. most definitely. It's very tactile.
Yeah, nice. Oh, that's so interesting. I think it sounds fascinating and a very interesting thing to be using in a hospitality space for sure. And I guess, when you're saying it's a little bit like an acoustic panel, does it have acoustic properties, acoustic dampening properties? Yeah, right.
Yeah. Mm. It's really fantastic for acoustics because it is such sort of a soft product, at least the mycelium finish.
Mm.
And then obviously the substrate that it has. So the waste product behind. In this case, it's a little bit like, I would say like the husk of a seed or something like that. It's husks. It's a little bit of maybe like a wood pulp or wood chips as well behind it. So given the buildup of the material, the acoustics are fantastic.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's amazing. But that's not the only alternative material that you used in Arpe Bar, isn't it? You've used a few other really interesting materials. So what else have you used? There was a leaves from, is it from pineapple?
Yeah. That's right. So
okay.
This is for basically like bench seating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's using the leaves that are cut off pineapples. So pineapples you'd find in a can typically.
Mm.
What happens to the leaves? They're typically burnt.
Interesting, really.
In massive fires, and then you're obviously producing carbon emission that way. Generally not fantastic. So they're a company called Pinatex, a little bit more developed than the Mogu in their product.
Mm-hmm.
They offer a few different varieties now, which is fantastic to see.
Wow!
But we use them for it's the leaves, and they extract the pulp from the leaves of the pineapple,
mm-hmm.
and then basically turn that into it's almost like a leather like material.
Ah, right. So using it instead of other types of upholstery or leather,
exactly.
Wow. Okay. Exactly. And then you can just use it like a fabric.
Yeah, so it becomes a fabric. So we used one variety of it for the seating,
mm-hmm.
where we actually made the seating almost as, how do I say, use as much material as possible, because it is sort of this carbon negative nature, right? So it's almost how many pineapple leaves can we get in this bench seat as an exercise. So, of course, we're using the client's funds to do this.
Mm.
It's a little bit of maybe a Robin Hood moment, I think, as an architect.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And then, we used it for branding and different assets as well, the menus, this type of thing, just wherever we could.
That's so fantastic.
To give it back to them.
Yeah, no, that's great. And because I have been to some restaurants where they have a leather binder on their menus. Is that the way that you used it on the menus? Or?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, wow. Oh, that's fantastic.
And you can really see the fiber. You can see the fiber, the texture of what it was.
Yeah, great.
It's almost like a felt material in a way.
Yeah, nice. Oh, that sounds really lovely. It sounds like, I haven't been to this restaurant, but it sounds like it's a wonderful tactile experience. And you also use some interesting timber. What did you? Yeah, what was the timber species that you used for in this product?
Yeah,
in this
project. I think timber's an interesting one. You've really got to look at where the timber comes from in architecture. Obviously, it's generally reported as being quite sustainable, and in a lot of cases, it is, which is fantastic. So, we went down basically a path of looking at what might be the most sustainable timber. And that's a timber that's been used for something else, is what we landed on. So there's a lot of rubber wood in the project.
Right. So timber from the rubber tree.
Yeah. So yeah, right. Rubber plantations.
Amazing.
So rubber trees in, obviously they're grown for extracting the rubber from them in plantations. So that's one use of them and the primary use. They're generally logged after a certain number of years when they slow down in terms of production and then also burnt typically in typical cases.
Wow. I wonder if, so much of the offcuts in agriculture just ends up getting burnt, it sounds like.
I think it's going to depend which country you're in and where these products are actually coming from. But for a lot of things like this, the byproduct, that's an easy solution.
Yeah, wow.
For a lot of people to deal with it, unfortunately.
Mm. Yeah, wow. Okay. So in this rubber tree timber, how did it end up coming to you? Is it still coming in boards or is it coming in, substitute pine for this type of timber, or was this more of the sort of joinery timber that you used in the space?
It's actually largely the finished product in terms of furniture, I should say.
Yeah, wow.
So you've got to be a little bit careful just in terms of the structural integrity of various timbers like this. But in cases where it is furniture that, who knows how long the furniture is actually going to last within the establishment, but it's hard wearing in that respect. And it comes in basically almost looks like a glulam. So lots of smaller pieces of the timber that are then sort of fused together. And then you typically will need to coat it in something and not have it be completely exposed.
Yeah, right. Interesting.
It's a hardwood, but it's a tropical hardwood.
Right. So the rubber isn't kind of embedded in the timber and provides its own sealant or anything like that.
I don't really know. Potentially, although I haven't seen it.
That's just me free thinking. I'm probably just assuming. It's just wishful thinking on my part, I think. But no, that sounds absolutely brilliant. I mean, the project sounds, like you've thought about so many different ways to use alternative materials, and I think it sounds like a really beautiful space to be in as well. And it sounds sort of like it's a like an izakaya, quite small. What's the square meter area of the bar?
I think we're around about 250 square meters.
Right. Okay.
In that case, with about 90 people.
Oh, that's nice. That's a good space. Yeah. But you've also worked on quite large spaces as well in this sort of hospitality realm. It's not not contained to sort of a standard restaurant environment. You've also worked on a brewery as well, where you've gone down the adaptive reuse path, but then also used some alternative materials. Do you want to tell us about Modus Operandi Brewery?
Yeah, of course. So Modus Operandi Brewery, so also in Newcastle, I guess technically in Merriweather, so sort of the suburb adjacent. It's about a 1,200 square meter brewery, so in terms of it produces beer there actually. But it's also a hospitality space and venue for about 300 people, as well as sort of the headquarters of the brewery company.
Great. Cool. And I mean, so tell us a little bit about the building that was there originally. So if it was an adaptive reuse project.
Yeah. So it was, it's a little bit of a complicated project logistically. It was over two sites, in the end, actually three, but two sites that we focused on. One site was basically a car workshop area. So a large shed. The other site was, when we came to it, it was vacant. So nothing really on it. But previously we know there'd been sort of like a petrol station on there. So think contamination, also a circus as well, 60 years ago. So quite a few different uses for the actual site. But yeah, when we got it, it was a vacant site next door to an existing shed, which was the car workshop.
Right. Okay. And then what did how much equipment and everything did the brewery have to bring in? Must have been extensive in terms of how much the practical nature of the building required.
Yeah. So, and I guess that's kind of the interesting thing, right? So it's called Modus Operandi in terms of the brand. So that's Latin for, the mode of working, or how you might work. So the design concept for the space is really allowing the public to be a part of the operation.
right?
To see the mode of working.
Mm.
So, I mean, in that case, we have, I think, in the end, something like 250 square meters of doors that
right
can open and close. Yeah,
right. So, how does that work in terms of the space being used? If there's all these doors throughout the building, is it are these partition doors? How does it all work?
Yeah, exactly. So they're typically sliding doors. I think the biggest one is about 6 meters tall and 15 meters long.
Mm-hmm.
So think kind of like an aircraft hangar in a way. And they basically caution off spaces in different ways throughout different times of the day or year also. So they're sliding large panels. And, you know, we kind of got into that point because it was approved with the City of Sydney Council as their first ever artisanal food and drink menu.
Yeah.
So kind of unusual typology.
Mm. And so what makes a artisanal space different to a standard hospitality space?
So this means that you need to have the production that happens on site being sold on site.
Right. Okay. Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah. So it means the beer you're getting there has been made there. Food is something different, but in terms of the primary activity, this is how it works.
Right. Okay.
And so... Yeah, so I was really working closely with council to figure out how the spaces can overlap at mm-hmm. different times of the day in the week.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have one capacity allowed through the liquor license and through the council, you know, a smaller capacity during the day with more production space,
mm-hmm.
And that flips at the evening. So less production, more hospitality.
Yeah, wow. And so, you know, I guess in my mind, if it's an old mechanics shed, it'd be kind of a big old, you know, warehouse style building, quite dark. Is the building, you know, quite dark inside and, you know, full of equipment? How did you sort of address, I guess, that old sort of warehouse typology?
Yeah. So it goes back to, you know, the brand, being modus operandi and the mode of working.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted everything to be light,
mm.
light and airy, and to have views and visibility across all the spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So you might be in one, you might have a wall between you and the production if something specific is occurring. But it's a case of you could see through that wall. So and this starts to talk to the materials where we use the large lighting partitions to be either transparent or semi-transparent, so translucent. Amongst most spaces in the venue, that meant opening up one side of the existing shed,
mm-hmm.
to let natural light in.
Mm-hmm.
And then for that opening to be to that new site, that new addition,
mm.
And for that to be as light filled really as possible.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so it's really well illuminated, I guess. So you've got skylights and things throughout the space, or have you used a completely different kind of roofing material?
Yeah, so in a lot of it, it's completely transparent as a roofing material. So for that and... speaking to the material of the project, that is a semi-recycled polycarbonate from Dampal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, quite a commonly used material in Australia specifically. And in that case, we really whittled down the project, I think, talking to sort of economic sustainability to just a couple of materials in really key moments.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an overly complex project, but it's a project that has a few key drivers.
Yeah. I think it's a fascinating project. I mean, looking at the slab, it also looks like it's a completely different material to a standard concrete slab. So what did you use there?
Yeah, so because of the production requirements of, you know, a forklift being able to go in every area of the venue, for example,
mm-hmm.
From hospitality to production, we developed a custom floor that is really just sand.
It's just so it's sand?
It's just sand, so it's almost like a scree that you would have, right?
Oh my god, that's amazing! So yeah, tell us a little bit more about this incredible floor that's purely sand.
So this flooring is everywhere in the venue. So obviously, it's a little bit of cost to develop something like this, but it's sort of consumed for the fact that it's 1,200 square meters of the one flooring material. So it's really just sand, locally sourced. It does have a clear sort of bioepoxy on the top layer
mm-hmm.
for durability concerns. But that's really almost what it is.
Wow.
And so you're seeing the natural variation of the sand and.
Yeah. But how do you get, I guess, the, you know, the sort of compressive strength of concrete? Is there some sort of binding agent?
There is a binding agent that we try to obviously reduce as much as possible. to mix with the sand. And, you know, part of the issue with this was when you're mixing a binding agent with sand, it effectively changes the color, right? Of it. So that was kind of a process that we thought would be relatively straightforward, became a 6-month long R&D procedure.
Wow.
Just to get this, the aesthetic, because of the binding agent.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, well, it's definitely got a unique outcome, and I think it makes, you know, it sort of lends itself to what you were trying to achieve when making the space feel light and warm, you know, because I guess a standard concrete slab would look that sort of light gray color or mid gray, and it kind of feels a bit cool. So, you know, this makes the space feel really nice and warm, which is lovely. And it's also echoed in the walls that you use in this project. So what have you used there?
Yeah, so a few different materials. One of them is just rammed earth. So obviously becoming quite a well-known material these days. So we use rammed earth, locally sourced limestone clay that was rammed in and around the space. Areas that didn't need to be flexible or movable were done in this material. Which, you know, it's particularly environmentally friendly as a material is locally sourced with minimal additives to it. And then as a material, it's also a natural humidifier to the space as well, because it remains unsealed.
And it's got a beautiful, you know, stratification in the colors as well. So how did you achieve that?
Admittedly, that was really just with a pigment.
Oh, wow. Okay.
nothing too grandiose there.
Okay.
I think the issue is we did experiment with different clays, so two different clays, and then trying to ram those together, which can be done to an extent. But oftentimes you get cracking. Just different composition of the clays. You'll crack along the line that the color separates. So the pigment, I think we're already pushing the durability of rammed earth in a production venue with forklifts and 300 people in there. To push it down one step further where we'd have cracking wasn't really an operational constraint that we could work with.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. But it looks like it came up beautifully, which is fantastic. And I'm not sure if I'm like the tiles in the bathrooms that you've used, they also, I guess, echo that kind of stratification effect where you've got light colors at the bottom and dark at the top. It's almost the opposite of the rammed earth walls that you have in the building. Those tiles look pretty unique. Where did they come from?
Yeah, that's a good pickup with the coloring there. So those tiles, I think, were even more of a process than the flooring.
Oh, really?
they're made originally 100% from recycled shampoo models. By a kind of startup company in Sydney that were using recycled plastics and a network of salons to make small products for the home, like coasters or I think dog leashes and this kind of thing. And we connected with them saying, you know, do you want a bit of a larger market, which could be looking at building materials and tiles. And there are many thousands of those tiles on the project. But yeah, it's basically connecting salons, hair salons in Sydney, and the plastics that they recycle, taking those, taking load off the recycling chain, because oftentimes recycling doesn't happen as efficiently as we expect it to.
Wow.
And then using those for these materials, so they're just pressed into shape.
That's really great. So you could choose any shape you want, and then that's great. So you actually designed that shape. And it came out exactly how you wanted it.
Yeah, it's just using pressure really into a mold, so a die cast mold to achieve that shape. And I think again, it sort of talks to the volume of the project being larger than the Appia project. You just have a certain quantity where you can make numbers work, and in this case, we could when you have that many thousand tiles to commission a mold to be made.
Yeah,
it starts to stack up economically, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's great. And I think you've used it to great effect in this project as well, which is lovely seeing it being used, you know, throughout so many different spaces. So it's a beautiful space. And I think anyone who's up in Sydney and wanting to do a bit of a brewery crawl probably should drop by there, because it looks like a great space. And this is in Newcastle, isn't it?
Yes. So, yeah. I mean, close enough to Sydney.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. But I guess you sort of mentioned here that you're got a bit of a specialization in hospitality, and it's always great to do that work, I guess, because you can experiment with all kinds of different materials, and you know, it sort of works for different companies that want to have a very specific look, or you know, something that lends itself to their branding. So that's really exceptional. But you do also work on houses as well, and you mentioned that you're working on a terrace house project at the moment that's got some interesting adaptive reuse considerations to it as well. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that terrace house project?
Yeah. So look, I think sort of hospitality was one of the hands that I was dealt early in my career in terms of what to focus on. But programmatically, we do tackle work really in any sphere or sector. It's more so a case of whether the client is looking for experimentation and whether we're the right fit as architects. And yeah, so this terrace project, look, I've never actually worked on a terrace project before. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably quite rare for a Sydney-based architect. but yeah, look, I mean, tackling one now. So it's based in Newtown. It's located in Newtown in Sydney. So quite an eclectic, fantastic area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a heritage listed premises, so internally and externally.
Oh, wow. So it's got heritage listing for both.
Right.
Wow. Okay. That's got some complications built into it.
So it's relatively constrained in terms of, at least especially in terms of the external form with what it might be. And so this project, it was built in, even we don't know the exact date, but the late 1800s, early 1900s. As a build-to-rent scheme.
Right, okay.
So a very, very early iteration of that where it was rented every year to somebody different for the first 30 years of his life.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's had a bit of a rough life.
Mm.
And we find it today angling about, I think it's about 8 degrees into the earth.
Oh, wow. Okay, so what's sinking, is it?
It's sinking quite badly.
Wow.
I mean, look, it's built on alluvial soils, right? That's the area is known for that.
Mm.
So what used to be sort of soil that would run off from every front is what is underneath it.
Mm.
And it's effectively returning back to country, which is quite interesting as a typology to tackle.
Yeah.
So that I guess has led us into how we started to design with it.
Mm.
Which is, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point, that the building itself is starting to, return itself to country. And the idea of acknowledging what is actually there, what is the original site and country, and finding ways for this work that you're about to do and this process you're about to go through must be quite fascinating, and that the buildings or the country itself is actually, taking part in this process. So, what sort of plans do you have moving forward to try to, work or sort of roll with this as opposed to fighting against it?
Yeah, so it's a case where the project hasn't been that well documented historically. It is heritage listed. However, we can't even tell when it was built. There are very few original plans and documents surrounding the actual terrace itself. That's coming from our heritage consultant and also neighbors. We obviously know some of the facade itself is quite ornate, quite detailed. Some of that detail is still remaining. However, we don't even know the exact materials of some of it. It's just degraded so much.
Mm.
So, as a mission statement, basically, what we can tell, when we tell that something was original or we know what it was, we'll reinstate that to acknowledge sort of the European heritage of the house itself or the terrace.
Mm.
But then areas where we actually, instead of sort of assuming something, where we don't have the information around it, we're looking just to work with country as much as possible in sort of a varying amount of ways.
Yeah, interesting. So, I guess with the building that's falling down, what do you think the end result is that you're aiming for will be?
So with this one, we'll need to reconstruct it almost entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an order from council, more or less. It's almost too far gone, unfortunately.
Mm.
Of course, we'll salvage what we can, especially in the facade,
and
reuse some of those materials. But there are areas like, there was sort of a stucco on the actual facade, covering some of the original bricks. There's no consensus amongst neighbors or heritage experts of what color it was, for example, or the exact composition of the stucco.
Mm.
So for that, we're just looking really to use clay sourced from the site as part of the stucco material. So then it's really reflecting the site itself in the area that it's in.
Mm.
Whereas the geometry, some of the geometry we'll take on is sort of the existing geometry that we know what it was. So from sort of a material perspective, that's how we're tackling the exterior.
Mm.
Then it goes into the interior where there's even less documentation.
Mm.
So there's, from our perspective, a little bit more earnest to work with country as much as possible in that space.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
From a material perspective, from a planning perspective, from a layout perspective.
Mm. Okay. So I guess, yeah, there's a few different, yeah, we've got a lot of different ways that you can sort of, yeah, acknowledge the, yeah, I guess the original country that it's sitting on and the way that the building is degrading and what, you know, has been told that you have to do by council. And then you're bringing in all of these different ways that you can try to respect, you know, the original country and what it's sort of telling you it has to do in terms of its the way that the soil is going to react over time. But then, you know, I guess you've also got this sort of abatement of the material of the existing building as well. So I guess that's also a huge piece that you're going to be working on too.
No, exactly. Mm. And you know how it completely manifests is yet to be determined.
Mm.
We're lucky that City of Sydney Council were quite open to our approach.
Mm-hmm.
So we've just had approval for this one from them, which is fantastic.
Mm.
In terms of following this procedure, they were open for that, especially internally. So internally, you know, we've had it approved with almost no internal divisions whatsoever within the space, just not to divide up the land any further than what a terrace already does, right?
Mm. Yeah. And I guess that's good. It's quite interesting where you're mentioning, you know, the building hasn't got much documentation related to it at all in terms of its built heritage. Have you spoken to the traditional owners to sort of understand a little bit more of its the living heritage that's connected to that site?
Yeah, we have spoken to a few, although the conversations really need to develop, I think, a little bit further.
Mm-hmm.
Up until this point, we weren't really sure how council would even take this kind of approach.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit unusual and, as far as you know, relatively unprecedented
right.
with City of Sydney. So we kind of wanted to get that a little bit squared away before we embark on this entire process.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. It sounds like it's going to be a pretty complex process to go through, but yeah, some really exciting outcomes that could come out of that for sure. So I guess, yeah, moving away from residential and sort of, I guess, speaking about, I guess, the underlying driver for using alternative materials and, you know, trying to be as sustainable as possible is you want to try to lower the impact of buildings, lower the impact that buildings have on the environment. And you sort of turned your eye as well to commercial towers that have glass facades. And you've developed a product that's, that it could sort of, yeah, I guess, reduce the impact that those tall glazed buildings have on our environment. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this product that you've developed?
Yeah. So this is the Solgami product. Actually, it was born out of my master's thesis at the University of Tokyo. So sort of looping back to that, I guess, formative stage. And it's developed bit by bit since then.
Mm.
So it's called Solgami. It's more or less a product that's to abate carbon from existing buildings.
Right. And when Solgami, I guess it's solar and origami mushed together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I love that. So you want to describe what this product is?
Yeah. So this, more or less, it's a screen that sits in the window.
Okay.
On the one hand, it redirects more light internally.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sort of reducing glare within internal spaces. And then you're taking light through the redirection through a geometry, light that would like just fall just within the window in a way, onto the ground, for example. You're redirecting that sort of back along the ceiling or within the space to get more natural, even illumination within buildings.
Great.
But so at the same time, we're also abating carbon through providing greater insulative material to the facade, to the glass, and also stripping the light that you're receiving from its infrared and ultraviolet radiation, which is the heat carrying capacity.
Wow.
Of light.
Okay. So is it, if I'm sort of imagining a piece of origami on a window, is it a bit like a fabric, like a folded fabric louver or something in a way where it's, as you're saying, it's sort of diffusing light and UV and all those sorts of things. Is that sort of what I could imagine?
More or less. So it's had a few iterations in its lifetime.
Mm. Okay.
Up until sort of 2019, that's definitely what we're doing. And we exhibited as part of the Lexus Design Award in Milan with this project. And that's definitely what it was. Mm. But now that project's been acquired by Vitra in Germany.
Mm.
And it'll form an exhibition there in early 2024 that'll run for 4 years globally, looking at energy and design.
Mm. This is fantastic. So, I mean, is this, if it's going to be offered or it's owned by Vitra, does this mean that any architect really can specify it in the future?
Yeah. So, look, our contract with them is for exhibition and display purposes only. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's part of a comment that they're making,
okay.
I guess, as the company and entity that they are on energy and design and using a little bit the status that they have, right? To say we should be looking at things in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
So from them, they're not offering it as yet, but we are looking to launch it sort of the second iteration in Milan in April in 2024.
Okay, cool. And is it for only for new builds, or is this something that could actually also be retrofitted onto existing glazed buildings?
Yeah, look, it can be for either. Primarily for existing buildings, though.
Primarily for existing buildings. That's great.
Primarily, because we have such an issue, right, where the biggest or the largest percentage of carbon emissions within our atmosphere have come from the heating and cooling of buildings, and specifically existing buildings and specifically glazed towers.
Right.
That's just glazed towers, obviously, as a typology developed sort of in the 50s, if you think about the Seagram building in New York, for example, when oil and energy, therefore, was incredibly, incredibly cheap.
Mm.
And that's where this typology came out from architecturally.
Mm.
Obviously, there's such a large amount of this typology building that exists within the world. There are ways to abate your operational emissions for new buildings that are various. Mm. And as architects, obviously, we look at that through some of our works. But in terms of existing buildings, I think that's the most difficult area to actually remove emissions from.
Absolutely, especially when we consider the heating and cooling costs of such massive amounts of floor area in glazed towers. Yeah, that would be a huge, huge impost on the grid, especially in when we've got heat waves in Australia, which seem to be our biggest problem. And so being able to basically come along and adapt a building so that then it can have some shading in that building that lowers its energy load when it's trying to cool itself dramatically during those huge spikes in temperature, that would be a huge outcome.
Yeah, look, that's the plan, because you know the heating and cooling in buildings, it's in terms of emission, it's bigger than transport, it's bigger than agriculture. So there's obviously a lot of innovation in the space looking at, you know, electric vehicles and transport, for example.
Mm.
But really the biggest percentage of carbon emission is coming from the heating and cooling of buildings. So I think that's an area where, you know, we're trying to look at obviously more intently with existing buildings and new buildings. Yeah, I think there needs to be a lot more innovation in the space.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation to hear more about all the incredible work that you've been doing, Ben. It's been really lovely to hear about how you, like your background, what you've been experimenting with on Ape Bar and Modus Operandi and your terrace house and also Solgami. I mean, it all sounds like you've got so many different plates spinning all at once, and it's all very exciting. Thank you so much for sharing so much about what you're doing at Prevalent. And yeah, I'd really like to have you back on the podcast and another time to talk more about the other projects that you have coming down the pipeline. So yeah, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Daniel. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers. This has been Hearing Architecture, proudly sponsored by Brickworks. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much to our guest in this episode, registered architect, director of Prevalent Architecture, Ben Berwick. Thank you so much for sharing your stories about your unique career overseas and how you're addressing sustainability. We can't wait to see what you do next.
Our sponsor Brickworks also produce architecture podcasts hosted by Tim Ross. You can find The Art of Living, Architects Abroad and The Power of Two at brickworks.com.au or your favourite podcast platform. If you'd like to show your support, please rate, review and subscribe to Hearing Architecture in your favourite podcast app. If you want to know more about what the Australian Institute of Architects is doing to support architects and the community, please visit architecture.com.au. This is a production by the Australian Institute of Architects, Emerging Architects and Graduates Network, in collaboration with Open Creative Studio. The Institute production team was Madeline Jenkins and Claudia McCarthy, and the Imagine production team was Daniel Moore. This content is brought to you by the Australian Institute of Architects, Emerging Architects and Graduates Network, in collaboration with Open Creative Studio. This content does not take into account specific circumstances and should not be relied on in that way. This content does not constitute legal, financial, insurance, or other types of advice. You should seek independent verification or advice before relying on this content in circumstances where loss or damage may result. The Institute endeavours to publish content that is accurate at the time it is published, but does not accept responsibility for content that may or will become inaccurate over time.